men who'd picked him up at the dock. They showed him where the food and the booze were stored on the plane, and in broken English, they said the flight would only be 2 hours. They did not tell him where they were headed, but they did not need to. Court knew. He was being taken to the boss, and the boss lived in St. Petersburg, Russia. Gentry leaned back and relaxed, sipped bottled water, and listened to Sidorenko's henchmen chat. Court's Russian comprehension had been fair at its peak a dozen years earlier, but it was extremely rusty at the moment. By concentrating on the chit-chat of the men around him, with his eyes closed for over an hour, he felt like he was retuning his brain to the nearly impenetrable language. He was reasonably sure that Sid and his men would have no idea that he spoke a word of Russian, and he thought he might be able to use their ignorance to his advantage in the hours to come. The Hawker dipped a wing and descended, landing just after noon. Court's assumption that he'd be heading to St. Petersburg to meet his employer was confirmed when, upon their descent, he spied the Gulf of Finland out the portside window. He recognized the airport as well. Rzhevka was to the east of St. Pete, less convenient to the city center than the main international airport, but Court had been to this airfield more than once. In the old days, 10 years or more before, Gentry had worked as a CIA singleton operator living undercover and alone overseas. Theoretically, his missions could be anywhere on the planet, in either friendly or enemy territory, but in practice, he operated more or less steadily in the former USSR. Russia, Ukraine, Lithuania, Georgia, Tajikistan. The CIA had reasons to send operatives from their autonomous asset program into the badlands of the East, tailing and chasing and sometimes even killing traitors of weapons or nuclear secrets. For a time, it seemed the only things worth selling from behind the former Iron Curtain were the surviving relics of Doomsday left behind by the former evil empire, and for a time, it seemed the only thing Court Gentry and other AAP men were ever asked to do was to head over there, follow a target, report on his activity, and or bug his house and or buy off his friends and or plant evidence to incriminate him of a crime. And or kill him. But those were the 90s, the good old days, pre-9/11. He'd been to St. Petersburg just once since, in January 2003. By then he was a member of Task Force Golf Sierra, the Goon Squad, a CIA Special Activities Division Special Operations Group paramilitary black ops team that hunted terrorists and their associates around the globe. Court and the Goon Squad flew into this very airport on an agency jet. Part of the team stayed in a safe house out in the countryside, while Court and Zach Hightower billeted in a ramshackle tenement a couple of blocks away from the posh hotels on Nevsky Prospect. And then, on their third week in town, the Goon Squad boarded Zodiac rubber raiding craft and hit a freighter leaving the port of St. Petersburg. On board was supposed to be nuclear material heading to Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Instead, it was conventional weaponry, stuff that went bang and not boom, as Zach Hightower had reported to Langley from his satellite phone at the time. They were ordered to leave the guns behind, to hop off the boat, and to get out of Russia. Perplexing, but it made sense later, sort of, when that very lot of goods was discovered in Basra, Iraq, and paraded in front of the media, Russian packaging and all. The ship had been tracked all the way to Iraq and the cargo monitored by satellite. The Marines who found it had been told where to find it, and the embarrassment for Russia nudged them a bit in their support of the U.S. mission there. Not much, really, but a little. It was politics, and politics wasn't the Goon Squad's stated mission. Court didn't like it, but as his boss, Zach, had said at the time, he wasn't paid to like it, he was paid to do it. From Sidorenko's airplane, Court was shepherded across 100 meters of frozen tarmac to a black stretch limousine. His minders led him to the front passenger seat. One man said, "You get in front. The back is for VIPs." He smiled, enough metal around his neck and teeth to pick up all local AM stations. "You are just a P." He laughed aloud, then translated his joke to his colleagues, and they laughed too. Court shrugged and climbed into the front seat. The minders, hardly VIPs themselves, got into the plush back. An absurd security violation. Court sat up front with only a late middle-aged driver, but Sidorenko's security men did not appear to be the smartest henchmen around. As they drove west towards St. Pete, Court did his best to retain information about the trip in case he needed to find his own way back to the airport. He planned on making this a very short journey. 30 seconds to tell Sid he didn't appreciate being dragged up here. A violation of his and Sid's agreement. Another 30 seconds to tell him he didn't appreciate being deceived about the hit he'd just performed. And a final 10 or so seconds to tell his Russian handler that he quit. And if Sidorenko's gold-chained, skinhead mouth breathers tried to stop him from leaving, then there would soon be more vacancies to fill in Sidorenko's organization. But in the end, it did not work quite the way Gentry had envisioned. Chapter 6. After an hour on the road, Court was taken to a massive home on the northern outskirts of St. Petersburg. He had never been in this suburb and admitted to himself that he could not even find this place on a map. The streets were wide and tree-lined. The properties were large and landscaped. The homes were old and stately. The limousine turned up a drive, and Gentry immediately focused on the home ahead. It was breathtaking from a distance. Architecturally speaking, it was magnificent. But as they got closer, it appeared to Court as if Sid's crew of dumbass henchmen also moonlighted as his landscapers and housekeepers, tasks for which they were even less suited than security. There were tents erected on the grounds, like a small military encampment, with smoking fires and young men standing around, apparently doing little or nothing. Several four-wheel drive vehicles, mud-covered and poorly maintained, were parked on the shredded lawn on both sides of the driveway. The facade of the mansion was covered in flaking paint, and the gravel roundabout parking space was covered with bottles, cigarette butts, and other trash. Gentry climbed out of the limo and was led through a kitchen that looked like something from a frat house whose house mother had run away after a nervous breakdown. Dishes upon dishes in the sink, plastic carryout trays covering every flat space, and vodka bottles rimming the floors like some sort of shabby chic glass trimwork. Court was no neatnik, but he could not help but wonder about the prospects for wildlife in this kitchen during the summer, and he felt thankful for the frigid air that made its way through the thin kitchen window to keep bug life from flourishing, and the 3 or 4 cats he'd noticed strolling around both the interior and the exterior of the mansion to keep furry vermin at bay. Next, it was 2 flights up a wide, circular staircase. Men sat on the steps, played handheld video games, chatted on mobile phones, read newspapers, and smoked. Each man with a submachine gun on his lap or a shoulder holster stowing an automatic pistol under his arm. Some wore typical Russian mobster suits, but most of them were in camouflage or army green, though not in any sort of coherent uniforms, more like the attire of survivalists or hunters. And they were all skinheads. Most stared up at Gentry with malevolence. He presumed it was his long hair and scruffy beard that served as indicators that he was not from the same club as they were. He even wondered if they thought he was a member of whatever particular ethnic group they blamed for all the problems in their shitty lives. Fuck 'em, thought Court. He knew he could kick any 5 of their asses without breaking a shine on his forehead. The only problem with his macho self-assuredness, he recognized, was that he'd seen at least 10 times that number of men so far on the property. Sidorenko's security setup clearly placed a much higher premium on quantity than quality. Finally, Gentry passed through a massive gilded double doorway and into an outer office. A male secretary sat behind a desk. He was well-dressed and instantly appeared to Court to be incalculably more competent at his job than were the 50 or so other jokers lounging around this regal shithole.
"May I take your coat, sir?"
the man inquired in English as he stood behind his desk and stepped around to greet Court.
"I won't be staying."
The secretary seemed momentarily nonplussed, but he recovered nicely.
"As you wish, sir. Please, right through those doors."
He motioned with a gracious smile, but then he spoke to the 4 guards.
"Stay close to him."
It was in Russian, but Gentry understood. It was another set of gilded doors, and on the other side it was dark. a large hall, the only light coming from a fireplace to the right of a massive desk at the far end of the wooden-floored room. There was no other furniture in the room, and it was as cold as a meat locker, even with a crackling fireplace. The room echoed like a cathedral as Gentry moved through the dark towards the man behind the desk.
"Wonderful to meet you finally, Mr. Gray."
Gentry recognized the voice of Gregor Ivanovich Sidorenko. It was high-pitched and nasal, and it matched his face somehow. The man was small of frame, with tiny eyes and narrow features. His eyeglasses seemed as fragile as the rest of him. But he was younger than Gentry had imagined him to be, maybe mid-40s, though he did not seem to be healthy. His thin face made him appear underfed, and his sunken cheeks were sallow, even in the dim of the room. Sid reached out a hand to Kort. Kort ignored it. He knew everything since Gdansk, the men, the plane, the limos, the guns, the attitude, was all orchestrated to demonstrate Sid's authority and control over Gentry. Small men with big power sometimes exert this power disproportionately to compensate for what they consider to be their shortcomings. Nothing Gentry had not seen before, but he knew that he had to fight fire with fire to exert his own dominance in the situation. "We had an agreement. We were not to meet face to face. You violated this agreement. I am not like the others that you control. You can't impress me with a third-rate crew of gold chains and poorly lubricated firearms. I only came along willingly to tell you this, and to tell you that I quit." The young minders around Kort could not understand his English, but from the foreigner's angry and aggressive tone, they moved closer to him and looked to their master for guidance. He stayed them with a raised hand, then wiggled his fingers at them, as if brushing them back into the corners of the room. They complied. Kort could hear their retreating footsteps behind him. Sidorenko did not take his eyes off of Kort. Instead, he slowly backed up behind the desk and sat down. He sipped purple tea from a gold-leaf glass. Kort thought the man to be intimidated, but the next words out of the Russian mob boss's mouth came forth calmly and with no discernible tremor.
"Have you ever seen a man boiled alive in a tub of acid?"
"Is that a rhetorical question?"
"A colleague of mine."
Sid held out a hand as if to allay his guest's fears.
"I did not do it. It was shortly after the auctioning off of state-owned enterprise. 93, I think it was. I was with a team of accountants and lawyers working for a mobster in Moscow. He was no oligarch, no great genius either, but he loved money above all, and he strong-armed his way into several department store chains and then scared off or killed off the co-owners. Anyway, he decided one of his employees had been siphoning funds from his legitimate holdings, and he brought us all to a meeting at his dacha in Odessa. There, waiting for us, were some very hard men. Spetsnaz paramilitaries moonlighting as henchmen for this cretin. We, there were nine of us, were all taken to a barn, stripped naked, and shackled to railroad ties. We were beaten and sprayed with cold water for 2 days. It was October. The oldest man, an attorney, died that first night. During the second night, our employer entered the barn and told us that if one of us confessed, he would, by doing so, save the lives of the others. No one spoke. The beatings continued for another 12 hours.
Kort looked around the room while Sidorenko spoke.
On day 3, another man was dead. I can't remember his face, a regulatory affairs expert, if I'm not mistaken. Our employer returned again and made the same offer as before. Again, no one confessed. I was certain he would kill everyone, but fortunately for the rest of us, the oligarch had a deep-seated mistrust of Jews. He noticed, lying there in the muck and blood, that one of us was circumcised. Natan Bolchova. He took him for a Jew, decided he was the deceitful one, and had a wooden water trough brought in from outside. It was filled with a solvent used for stripping lead-based paint. Powerful stuff, and Natan was thrown on the ground next to the trough. for nearly an hour. Our Spetsnaz tormentors used shovels to splash the acid on poor Nathan as he writhed on the straw. He turned red, and then the skin began to bubble and pop off him, leaving him covered in the most brutal sores. The rest of us were forced to watch. Finally, because the men with the shovels grew tired of the work, they grabbed hooks used to lift bales of hay, and they pierced them into Nathan's arms and legs. They threw him right into the acid bath. The rest of us, Nathan's friends and colleagues, willed him to hurry up and die for both his benefit and ours. He screamed a scream I will never forget, until finally his melted face went under the liquid and did not emerge. It was a horrifying experience.
Court recognized that Sid enjoyed telling the story. He did not know what to say, so he said, "Sounds like stealing from this man was not a good idea." Sid shrugged, reached for his tea as he replied matter-of-factly,
"Oh, Nathan was perfectly innocent. I am the one who embezzled the money. Used it ultimately to go into business for myself. Our employer let the rest of us leave. He himself was killed in 94, shot in the back while getting fitted for a suit in Moscow."
Court sighed. "Is there a point to this story? Because if there is, I don't get it. Or am I just supposed to be frightened by it? Because I'm not." Chapter 7.
"The point is, I want you to understand who I am. I can be your friend. I want to be your friend. But if you come into my home and speak to me as you have just spoken to me, if you show me no respect, I can be your enemy. Do not let my pleasant regard for you allow you to think you can disrespect me in my home. I am a man who has evolved into where I am. I did not begin like this. To be a success in Russia, you need equal measures of two things, brains and brutality. This mobster I spoke of, he was a brute. Killing a man like that was effective, but then to go out by yourself to buy a suit and get shot, surely he did not have the brains to understand the consequences of his brutality. Other men, accountants like me, for example, they have become involved in crime because they have the brains for success. But in this vicious environment of competition and institutional corruption and the bloodthirsty hunt for money at all costs, the accountant criminals were swept from the chessboard even faster than the brutal fools. I realized there was no one who had both the brains and the stomach. Someone with the brains for business and the stomach for violence could survive and thrive in the new Russia like no one else. I had the brains. This I knew. But the stomach, that took a while to develop."
"So, do you throw your employees in acid?"
"No. My employees are treated well by me. They are National Socialists, if you had not yet guessed. They beat immigrants for fun. They think you are from the Caucasus from your complexion and hair, so they are no fans of yours. No, I do not threaten them. I let these young men live as they wish, give them free run of my home, and I pay them extremely well."
"In gold chains?" Sid laughed, genuinely amused.
"No, not in gold chains, in euros. Used to be in dollars, but, well, time marches on. You can come here angry as you are, and you can tell me you do not want to work with me any longer. But, Mr. Gray, I promise you, I am the best that there is for what you need."
On the wall to Gentry's left and Sid's right was a huge painting in a massive gilded frame. In the smoky light of the room, the square face and penetrating eyes of Joseph Stalin stared back at Court. "Cute picture," Court said, as he sat down in an uncomfortable wooden high-backed chair in front of Sid's desk. Sidorenko regarded the portrait as if he had only just noticed it.
"Yes, I respect the authority that it conveys."
"You don't strike me as one of the old guard."
"What do you mean by that?"
"A commie. I thought all of you billionaire mobsters were capitalist pigs like the rest of the civilized world. Sidorenko laughed with his mouth open and a high gurgle in the back of his throat.
Yes, I am a pig, but not an ideological one.
He stared at the portrait as he said,
He was a terrible man, yes, but Uncle Joe said perhaps the most brilliant words ever spoken. He said, Death solves all problems.
Court finished the quote. No man, no problem. Sidorenko smiled appreciatively.
Of course you would know this. It is your own personal mission statement, is it not?
It is not. Sid shrugged.
An operational credo, then?
He did not wait for Court to answer.
Stalin, the Romanovs, the Great Patriotic War, the current skinhead Russian nationalist phenomenon. I have, you see, an affinity for terrible, terrible things. I am a fan of the power of cruelty. A man who has the ability to inflict death and